I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Dara here. My crazy promo. That sounds kind of like angels. I don't know. I never understand this thing. A new way of life for me here at Off the Menu. All right, so I am Dara Moskowitz Grumdahl. I'm a restaurant critic, food writer, wine writer at Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine. I have been so busy this week doing event after event after event. But you know who's busier than me? A turkey farmer at Thanksgiving. And that is who we have on the second half of the show. John Peterson from Ferndale Farms is going to come in and talk about what it's like to be a sustainable, humane, small farm turkey farmer. Yeah, in the year 2019, that's a thing. He's going to tell us about it. But before that, we have a bona fide British food genius who's talking at Harvard tonight. Yeah, that Harvard. One of Harvard Yard. And but we're going to get her first. So Nikki Segnet kind of blew the doors off the barn with her last book, The Flavor Thesaurus. It's got to be up to 500,000 copies in print by now. It's a way of thinking about food that's different, thinking about flavors in a basic way. And she followed it up with her new book. I got it right in front of me. It's called Lateral Cooking. And it's kind of does the same thing for recipes that the flavors thesaurus did for flavors. And it kind of takes every culinary category, like bread or soup and stew, and it kind of backtracks it to the absolute basics and shows how, you know, little additive steps make different sort of categories of food. It's a very cool thing. And I am very honored to have Nikki on the phone. I'm going to guess from Massachusetts. Is that where you are?
I am. I'm in a hotel in Massachusetts, in Cambridge, actually.
In Cambridge, even, at Harvard. I think you'll be very excited to be surrounded by people who will tell you where they went to school. Okay, so tell me about lateral cooking. It's a very deceptively, you know, it's a deceptive idea. How did you come up with it?
So, well, quite a long way round. It took 8 years to research and write Lateral Cooking, but I started it as a book about how to flavor different kitchen basics. So I was quite interested in having a selection of skeleton recipes that you could then, you know, do all sorts of strange things to. So you could maybe, you know, apply classic flavors, but because writing the flavor thesaurus had left me with a kind of flavor cast of mind, I was really thinking about, like, what if I want to do something really crazy and interesting with ice cream or with risotto or with polenta? And so I set about writing this book of skeleton recipes, but then the more I got into researching thousands of recipes from around the world, the more I started to see the whole culinary world as a family tree. And so what I ended up with Lateral Cooking is 77 starting points, which are kind of cornerstones of family in each one.
I'm very interested in your soup stock soup and stew chapter, because it really kind of takes it down to like the essences, which I know what you were trying to do, but let's kind of talk about this. You know, is there are all things that are more liquid than solid, are they all soup?
Well, I think the thing about your stock soups and stews group is it starts with the very most basic idea, really, that all of those things are about, for the cook, about brokering a deal between liquids and solids. And so that group begins with stock, which is where, you know, you put a load of stuff in and then usually you drain it out and throw it away and keep the liquid and use it for something exquisite, hopefully. And then to broth, where you actually keep the things that you're using to flavour the liquid and eat them, maybe not in the same meal. And then to soups, and then chowders and stews and dals and big bean stews and risottos. So everything progresses along that family in a very natural way.
What do you think of bullion, about stock? What do you think about it in terms of the modern era? Because I always have, in the winter, you will find a giant pot of, you know, such kind of chicken broth on my stove basically the whole winter, because I'm always throwing new things in there and taking and just boil it, and that gets rid of the germs. And then, you know, you kind of are emptying it and replenishing it as you go. But when I talk to people that are new to cooking, it can seem very daunting. You're buying, you know, $20 of ingredients to just basically throw out.
Oh, well, unless you just use your old roast chicken from the Sunday roast and make a stock with that. I mean, I'm with, firstly, I'd like to move in with you, because somebody who's got a pot of chicken stock, proper chicken stock, on the hob all winter through is somebody I would like to live with.
It's a bit of an exaggeration, but a lot of it, because it's really, first of all, it's easier to just keep it going than it is to package it up and break it all down.
You boil it, as long as you bring it to the boil once a week.
Yeah.
From what I've read, it's fine. And, you know, the technique with most of these things is cooling them down fast to avoid getting all sorts of nasty things. But, you know, I don't know, with chicken stock, I just, when I look back and think about all the most delicious things I've eaten in my life, nearly all of them come down to good stock, like the savory things. So I think you're onto something. It's just, but it doesn't have to be chicken. And I suppose that's the thing. In lateral cooking, the starting point for the stock section is chicken, because that's the thing we probably make the most often. But then when we get into all the different flavor variations and things that we might do, of course, there's beef and pork and shellfish and all the standard kind of protein-based ones. But then there's also pea pod stock, and using butternut squash peelings to make stock, or pumpkin skin makes really, really good stock. It can make all the difference to soups and risottos made with those ingredients.
Oh, I should have had you on a few weeks ago. I think everyone in North America had some pumpkin skins and scraps for a bit there. I have never in my life used pumpkin scraps to make stock. What's good about it? Does it make it creamy?
It makes it, no, what it does, in fact, you throw them away like you do with your chicken carcasses. What it does, it just cook them, brown them a little bit in the oil before you put in the water and a few other aromatics. It brings a depth that you don't normally get in a vegetable soup. It's the same with the pea pods. I don't know if you've ever made that Italian risi e bisi, that kind of soupy risotto with peas. They use the pea pods to make the stock, and it gives depth in the same way that skins and bones do. You just get it just a little darker, a little bit. I mean, we know with a lot of vegetables, certainly with fruit, that a lot of the flavor is in the skin. So you can just, you know, fry them up a bit, get some brown on them, and then put the liquid in, a bit of wine, a bit of tomato puree, and you end up with something that is 1,000 times better than a bought vegetable stock.
Yes. So that's the thing I was going to bring up next, is that, you know, I've seen so many cookbooks. We're now in 50 years of cookbooks that start with canned chicken broth, or require bouillon cubes, or these things that don't taste like anything.
No, they taste like canned meat.
Yes.
And, you know,
if that.
I don't, if you like eating canned meat, that's fine. But I don't, you know, if you're putting loads and loads of flavor into something, if you're making a curry, it's not going to make that much difference what your base stock is. But if you're going to taste the stock at all, you cannot beat making it from scratch. And I'm always amazed to read chefs and, you know, experienced food writers saying, oh, it's okay, you can use this. I felt like I had to say what I really believe, which is, well, I mean, you can, but it's not going to be the same. A French onion soup that's not made with proper stock is never, ever anything like as good.
And chefs are basically lying, because they would never serve that in their kitchens.
They were telling you what you want to hear. And I think that what they should do is they should tell us what we should, you know, what we need to hear to be better cooks, and not what we, you know, what is convenient.
All right. I'm on Team Nikki. That is where I fall down too, because I think you should just use water you know, it's a better option most of the time than actually all the time. I never use any of those fake things. I think they're
yeah,
nuts.
Yeah, water gives you at least a kind of pure flavor. It gives water a bit of salt, maybe a tiny bit of honey and maple syrup in there just to tease out a little extra flavor. Yeah, I'm with you.
So do you find that there's a basic food illiteracy in the cultures in the North these days, or do you find that there is a food literacy? Are your works kind of falling on people who know how to cook, or is this just a revelation to them? They're like, oh my gosh, you can make crackers.
I mean, I write for people who love to cook, and there's no doubt about that. There is nothing in my work that is trying to convince somebody who would rather not that they, you know, that they should make some bread.
Or well, they can't. If they'd rather not, they're opting out of the whole situation. But I do.
Yeah, and that's fine. So my conversation in the books is very much, a kitchen conversation, maybe over a glass of wine with somebody who really likes to be there. But what I've done with both books is, I suppose, reverse engineered what we're doing, which is certainly I learned to cook from cookbooks. I didn't learn to cook with my mama or my nonna or anyone who gave me any kind of loose-limbed, cool, intuitive way of behaving in the kitchen. I learned sort of step one, step two, step three, and it took me 20, 25 years to get to the point where I could see a way out of that. And that's the interesting thing about both books. They are, you know, they are guides to becoming more intuitive, more knowledgeable, and more, you know, and so they're honest, and they're, you know, and in some ways they're basic, but they also, they work very well with chefs because they tell you lots of interesting things about ingredients and technique.
So so I'm going to just push this. Do you find, so you're, what I think you're saying is that you're finding the people that find you are food literate. You're talking to an already cooking comfortable universe of people, and they want to have a cozier, more intuitive.
I don't think they necessarily need to have a lot of skill or a lot of knowledge to like what I'm doing. So I have, you know, had letters in the past from people who, I mean, from one 80-year-old widower who is living in the Scottish Shetland Isles, who wrote to me to tell me that he was using my book to learn to cook because he had to become an ingredient-led cook, because all he had in terms of ingredients was what came in on the boat every week. Mm. And so it wasn't much use having a lovely glossy color cookbook with lots of different recipes if you don't get that ingredients. You need to start with, you know, with what's in front of you.
Yeah, I know a lot of people get frustrated with the recipe of the week that, you know, calls for something you don't have. You need, all of a sudden, you need a packet of kefir lime leaves, or you need, any number of things. I mean, culture came out of cooking with what you had. That's right.
Yeah.
Italians cooked with what the Italians had. The Swedish cooked with what the Swedish had. That was where the cuisines came from.
Yeah, and I mean, that's why when I give the 77 starting points on the same page, you have a whole list of notes about, you know, the ingredients mainly, saying, well, if you don't have 5 eggs to make this, actually you can make it with 3, and if you want to use gluten-free flour, then it will work here, or it won't work here. All those kind of practicalities that we face as cooks, that I've built them in because I think that's pretty normal. And if you have been, or you are a bit of a recipe robot, it's very useful to know what leeway you've got. So they're actually kind of under a heading of leeway. So they're sort of practical things that you can do and still come out with roughly the same dish.
Okay, I'm talking to Nikki Signet. Her book is Lateral Cooking. Nikki, I have one vital question I need to ask you, but we're going to take a break here. We're going to come back, and I really want to talk to you about, and this is going to sound crazy, but I really love your baking recipe, and you make a persuasive case for crackers that I've never heard before. So we're going to do that when we come back. We'll take a little break here. Sarah here. All right, I'm talking to Nikki Signet. She's the author of The Flavor Thesaurus. You just might have that on your shelf. Her new book is Lateral Cooking, and it's a very kind of smart decoding of all of cuisine in a lot of ways. I have to say, the chapter that kind of blew me away the most was really the first one, because I have led my life not really that interested in crackers. And then I looked at the way that she presented this as sort of a the very foundation, the simplest thing you can do. And I suddenly, like a aha moment, a light bulb went off over my head. So let's talk about the origins, the genius of flatbread and crackers.
So that's the first starting point in the book. It's the first starting point on what I call the bread continuum. And it is the most simple thing in the world, isn't it? It's you take a couple of cups of flour and a bit of salt, and then you put some water in it until you make a dough. And so there you have, give it a little knead, and there you have the dough to make crackers or flatbread, if you like. I mean, if you're going to make flatbread, you roll it out and then maybe cook it on the grill or cook it on the hob, put it in the oven, doesn't really matter. If you want to make crackers, you cut it, you roll it out thinner and then cut it into shapes maybe and then put it in a hot oven. And it's that simple. But what becomes very interesting about that very basic dough is that if you use buckwheat and a bit of ordinary wheat, you can make a Japanese noodle dough. And if you use a bit of fresh coconut with your white wheat flour, you can make a Sri Lankan flatbread called a pol roti. And if you use chickpea flour with some chopped up spinach and some nigella seeds, you can make an Indian flatbread, or you can make chapatis, or if you use masa, you make tortilla. It's just the most unbelievable, versatile, international dough in the world.
Yeah, it really struck me in a way. You know, I've been a restaurant critic for a long time. I've been a cook for even longer. And I always just, you know, people are constantly making crackers, chefs are, and it always just seems like, well, crackers you can buy crackers, they're pretty cheap. A box of saltines won't run you much. And then I just haven't really thought that much about them. I went to a lecture on historical Swedish cooking, and, you know, this whole thing about how farmers would, you know, have one season of harvest and then just everybody would just put everything down and spend a week making flatbreads, which are basically crackers. And that was then the basis of the eating of the next year. You could never eat more than, one 365th of the flatbreads that you had on hand because you had to wait until next year. And your sort of the simplicity with which you present it, it's like that's the there's much said about bread as the staff of life. This kind of really struck me as just like, oh, crackers are even the staff of the state. You know, it's one step down. It's kind of where it all began.
Yeah, because before there was leavener of any type, then, yeah, you had to kind of make do with what you had, you know, maybe a bit of sourdough. The rye crackers that you're talking about, though, I mean, you can buy them. You're right. And like you say, they won't cost you that much. But, you know, sometimes you just make things for the pleasure. The feeling of a rye dough in your hand is a very, very unique experience. It's very heavy. It's a bit like mixing up one of those clay face masks. But it's also, they taste incredible because it's like any bread. It's like if it's fresh, even if it's, you know, it's baked in the oven, it comes out, it's got that smell. It is a bit, I suppose it's crazy if you're used to buying crackers. But if you love cooking, it's not crazy.
And if you want to understand, you know, if you want to have that really, you know, maybe you don't do it all the time, but if you want to, you know, sort of peer into the volcano, as it were, if you want to look into the Grand Canyon of all culture and cuisine, you know, if you really want to know what's in there, make a batch of that.
Yeah. You know, at least, you know, if you don't love it, you've done it once and it's starting to tick off. I mean, that's why I propose that people try making a panettone or they try making a brioche. It's like, at least if you've done it once. What was the other thing? Croissants. I mean, I've never made them since I made them researching the book. But I remember what it felt like to make them. I know what they smell like in my kitchen when I'm cooking them from scratch. I know some of the intricacies of rolling a croissant. It's just a joy and perhaps a, you know, part of the rich jigsaw that you're talking about.
Very interesting. It takes a lot. It takes a special intelligence to take everything that you're just kind of immersed in and then kind of back it out. I was reading for some reason about the history of oxygen, about the discovery of oxygen. And, you know, it was the 1790s. And just think about what it took to suddenly be like, oh, there's the air is not just the air. It's stuff. It's made of things. And people had so many rival theories. That's what your book reminded me of. You're just kind of taking everything that we swim in and just backing it out and finding the atoms at the core. So I really can't compliment you enough. It's a remarkable book.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Nikki Segnet. Have a good talk at Harvard tonight. We're very delighted you gave us your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I wish I was in Minneapolis as well.
I wish you were too. Then we could complain about how great it is together. That would be fun.
I'm good at.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. That was Nikki Segnet. The book is Lateral Cooking. I'll put a link to it on the old Darren.Grumdahl Facebook page. All right, we're going to come back. We're going to talk to a turkey farmer. We're just getting the basics today. Bread and turkey and stock, all the good stuff when we come back. Dara here. Do you think you're as busy as a turkey farmer at Thanksgiving? Well, let's check it out. Let's fact check it. I got John Peterson on the line. He is a farmer owner behind Ferndale Market. That's the turkey farm halfway between the Twin Cities and Rochester in beautiful Cannon Falls, Minnesota. All right, John Peterson, how busy are you?
Oh, man, Dara, thanks for having me on. This is probably my one chance to catch my breath, so I'm grateful for the chance to be on with you this morning. I can sit down for a few moments here.
I just picture you like, you know, Abbott and Costello or something, just running around with turkeys everywhere.
Well, that's not far from the truth. And, you know, the funny thing for us is that it's just the busy season all across our, you know, all across our farm and in our store and delivering turkeys out to the co-ops that carry our fresh Thanksgiving turkeys. So all aspects of our life and world are awfully busy this time of year.
All right. So first, I had a question, which is when you say fresh turkey, do you mean that it hasn't been frozen, or what do you mean by fresh turkey?
That is exactly what we mean by fresh turkey. And this is the one time of year where we offer fresh, never frozen turkeys. And it takes a lot of work and planning on our side to be able to achieve all of the different sizes that folks are looking for. So we
I'm gonna interrupt you and just the reason that that's a big deal is because freezing. This is how freezing works. It turns everything in every cell membrane in a food into ice, and it ruptures a bunch of the cell membrane. So people that are food snobs, such as myself, we make a big, big stinking difference between food that's been frozen and food that has been never frozen. And a lot of people know that when you get one of those kind of giant turkeys from the, you know, big box store, it could take 5 days to defrost because they freeze them the crazy, like, you know, temperatures of the moon kind of thing, because a lot of them are processed last March, last April, and they just have to wait, you know, be sort of pristine and deal with any power outages or shipping or all the things they got to deal with. So, I mean, they freeze them like rocks, and you have something else. You have something that's never been frozen, and that will always be less dry. Well, of course, unless you mess it up when you're cooking it. But if you know what you're doing, if you're able to make a good turkey, it will be a factor better. And so, John Peterson, now I will stop interrupting you.
Well, no. Absolutely. I agree. I agree with you. And you're right. I'm glad you started with the convenience factor, because a lot of people don't take into consideration how long it takes to thaw a frozen turkey. And so there's certainly, in addition to, you know, a quality factor there, there's also a, you know, a real convenience piece to being able to pick up that turkey a day or two before the holiday and to know that it is a fresh, never frozen turkey, and it's ready to cook, ready to roast when you get it.
Do you know off your head what's the temperature that they freeze those ones to that are so super, super frozen?
I don't know, but I do know that it's cold.
Yeah, it's something. It's close. It's like 5 degrees or something like that. I don't know. Yeah. But so you, obviously for you, it's a huge supply chain thing. Like you have to back it up. Like you have to get the baby pullets and you have to raise them and do all the things to get to the point where they're the right size at Thanksgiving.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's the fun part of the story for the consumers is that, you know, they do have some transparency to see all the way back, you know, to our farm and to know how the turkeys were raised. But you're right. All of that takes a lot of coordination. And, you know, we don't have the scale or complexity that one of the big, you know, global meat companies would. And so it really is the time of year where we're all hands on deck to be able to pull it off and ensure a good Thanksgiving holiday for all the families that count on us for it.
Yeah, so if people want to see what your turkeys look like when they're living the life or get driving directions, all the things, the website for y'all is ferndalemarket.com. And if people are kind of on the fence, like do they actually want to, you know, get out of their rut, you're having a turkey fest.
Exactly, yes. So our turkeys are available, as you know, across the Twin Cities at the Natural Food Co-ops or at Kowalski's. But one other fun thing for us is that we have a store right on our farm here in Cannon Falls, like you mentioned, a scenic community just south of the Twin Cities. And at our on-farm store next weekend, the 23rd and 24th of November, we host our annual Turkey Fest, which is the first chance to pick up a fresh Thanksgiving turkey, but we really turn it into a celebration of all things local, particularly for the holidays. So we'll have lots of sampling. We've partnered with Birchwood Cafe for a great turkey gravy. We partnered with a local orchard and pie maker for an apple pie. All these things will be sampled along with lots of other real local partnerships that we're proud of during this Turkey Fest next weekend, along with live music and fun festive atmosphere. So it really is a fun tradition here on the farm and give people a chance to come right to the source of their Thanksgiving turkey.
Yeah, and I can't recommend that enough. It really makes you feel like you live somewhere. You have a connection to where you are. It is so cool. I've been to Ferndale Market a number of times, and it just gives you a feeling that you just can't get other places. You see actual farmers. You see that the food that you're eating is being raised by people you can see who have care and ethics and regard for you. It just feels so much better in this world, which has, you know, severed so many people's connections to the world that we live in. You know, we're moving here for work. We're moving there. We're in our screens. We're busy all the time. It just makes a huge difference. And you guys do such a great job.
Well, thank you. And I want to say that is really a reciprocal thing. And, you know, we as a family don't take that for granted at all. I think one of the biggest problems that, you know, that we have in our ag world today is that there's just anonymity all around. You know, consumers certainly don't have the chance, like you said, to meet their farmer. But likewise, most farmers are, sort of trapped in this system that keeps them, somewhat separated from the folks that are going to enjoy the product that they raise. So there's a lot of joy for us in this time of year to see people come to the farm and to appreciate the different way that we grow our turkeys free range and without antibiotics. So that really is a reciprocal thing, and not something that's lost on us at all. We appreciate that that face to face that so rarely happens in agriculture today.
Yeah, and I know that everybody's so busy today, but it's a big deal. Like, you should grab your teenager. Take them down and let them see what a real farm is. Because if you don't do that, there's a really good chance that their understanding of what a farm is going to be fed to them by PETA on the internet. And that is a false understanding. And so if you want to, you know, have people that understand what farming is, you know, make sure that you're giving them the chance to know and you're not just expecting them to have your own childhood experience. Yeah, you know who I'm talking to. You're out there and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Have I been, you know, taking my kids to farms? Have I been letting them see my values? All right. So that's what I have to say. I try to drag my children all around. They love that. I'll tell you what.
as a farmer, I couldn't agree with you more, Darren. You know, we do during the summertime, we do a farm tour day held in conjunction with the Natural Food Co-ops. And I love those days for people to come and pull back the curtain and see how their food is grown. As a farm family that takes a lot of pride in the way we do it, those are some of our favorite days of the year.
Yes. All right. So this just, I like to paint this as a win-win-win. So you support your local community, you get a better turkey, you get to pass on the values of supporting our farmers to a new generation, because they're getting to see it and it's getting all that good stuff. So it's a win-win-win. And John Peterson from Ferndale Market, I can't thank you enough for talking to us. I just feel like I'm just interrupting Santa as he's going down the chimney. Like, do you have a minute? I've got questions.
I can't thank you enough for the break. This is wonderful. Much appreciated, and appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about Turkey Fest next weekend, and we'll hope folks can join us here.
All right. Well, thank you for raising all the turkeys so that we can all have good Thanksgivings. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'll get back to it right now.
All right. Thank you. All right, everybody. That was John Peterson from Ferndale Market. You can find him at ferndalemarket.com. I really do encourage you to I did an event at the Science Museum this week, and I love the Science Museum. They are an amazing place. Then I got a lot of questions. People were finding me after this talk that I gave, and it's kind of asking about the future of food, and there's so much malarkey in the world. People are like, oh, we're all going to just eat faux meats and all these things. Like, we have just ceded territory to a generation who's gotten all their information about farming from social media. I feel like we're really aware of what social media has done in the political space, and we're only going to soon see what social media has done to farming. Like, how I looked the other day for positive, normal news about just dairy milk. There was nothing. We have lost the information war. I mean, milk is a thing that has supported humanity for generations. And just a whole bunch of people seem to think, not even seem to think, a whole generation has this idea that these bonkers, nut milks and soy milks and flour milks, that all these things are as valuable as dairy milk. And that's really just mischief making on the internet and marketing. And we have to do something. We have to support farmers. We have to communicate real values. How we do this? I don't know. We're going to take a break and pay some bills. We'll find out when we come back. Sarah here. So you can find me in all the places. You can find me on that malevolent Twitter machine, at Dear Dara. You can find me on Facebook. I'm Dara.Grumdahl. You can find me on the Instagram, where I haven't been much lately. It's so many channels to feed all the time. I start to feel like a dairy farmer myself. It's like, oh, I got to get over there. Feed the content. Put the content in all the stalls. Make it happen. All right, this is the time of the show where you can ask me anything. I got a question. Someone's looking to cut down on their Diet Coke. Do I have any ideas? Oh, I got ideas. Have you ever had hibiscus tea? This is a thing that I am very into right now. Hibiscus, of course, that's the flowers. You maybe see them in backyard patio pots. They're beautiful. There's a long tradition of drying them. They have a tart flavor, a beautiful color. And you can get them at the fancy tea shops, blended with different things. Tea Source in St. Paul has a hibiscus, orange peel, lemongrass blend. I think they call it just Minnesota Nice. It's a wonderful, wonderful tea. Tea blending is a wonderful art that I don't talk enough about. But you can also just get straight up red zinger, and you can keep a box in that at your desk. And the reason I've been interested in hibiscus tea lately is because it has a bunch of cardiovascular benefits. But I really do believe that almost any time you study any plant that people eat, you'll find these cardiovascular benefits. Because anyone who invests money in looking into pomegranate juice, looking into green tea, looking into hibiscus tea, they always find benefits. So we just, as a species, our bodies want good plant material. And so hibiscus tea is a good thing to substitute for your Diet Coke. Green tea or peppermint tea. It's all of them. The eternal question, what do I think is the future of Beyond Burgers? I don't I don't have any faith in the future of Beyond Burgers. I think they're a flour oil slurry made into a patty. And I think that once people realize that when people said eat more plants, they meant eat more Brussels sprouts, not eat more oil slurry patties, and that that's not how you lose weight, not how you gain health, that they will fade in prominence. I think they're a big trend. All right, next week, Pasta Grannies. One of my favorite books of the year. This is the one that I have been texting chefs in town all about. This woman went up and down Italy, talked to all the grandmas, got their, you know, handmade wonderful recipes. So grab your favorite granny. You are not going to want to miss it. And if you grab your least favorite granny by mistake, don't blame me because I'll deny it next week here on Off the Menu.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.